Thank you, Ken. My name is Charlie Farman. I'm a very grateful, recovered alcoholic. Because I am a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and by the grace of the power that I found in the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink for 8,348 days today, one day at a time, and for this I'm very grateful. And again, it's good to be behind this microphone getting ready to talk about the thing I love to talk about the most, the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. I always like to say, as we do anything on the Big Book, that we certainly do not consider ourselves to be the gurus of the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't consider ourselves to be the experts on anything at all. My friend Joe and I, two old drunks, met together several years ago and found we had a mutual interest in the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. And from that mutual interest, we managed to get the opportunity to study it together off and on for several years. And hopefully we learned a few things about it, and those few things we know we love to share with other people. We certainly do not speak for AA as a whole. And you are free to agree or disagree with anything that you hear us say today. In fact, if you hear us talk about things that can't be reconciled with what's in the Big Book, you probably ought to just disregard that completely. I always like to also remind people that our book does say that we are meant to be joyous, happy, and free. And I take that to mean that we're meant to have a good time. I've had about all the sad face. I've had about all the crying. I've had about all the depression that I want in my life. And I insist on having fun and enjoying myself everywhere I go. And I think if we can all approach life in that manner, and be able to approach our Big Book in that manner, we'll find that not only can we learn things about our book and about our program and about ourselves, but we can have fun while we're doing it. And you know, I love to tell jokes, and I nearly always start one of these sessions with a little joke or a story of some kind. And Friday night I told a joke about our friend Charlie Lindenwood, and most of you were here heard it. And I've got another little story I'll tell today, and it's about another mutual friend. And he's sitting over there behind the taping table, or he's standing there right now. Most of you know Bob. He's been down in and around this Georgia and Florida area forever. And they tell me not long ago, Bob got sick also and had to go to the doctor, just like old Charlie did. And they checked old Bob over, and the doctor really couldn't find a whole lot wrong with him. And he said, "Bob, I'm sorry, I really can't pin down what your problem is." But he said, "What I'd like to have you do is come back next week." And he said, "When you come back, we're going to run some tests, so I'll need to have you bring me some samples, some specimens." And Bob said, "Okay, what do you want?" He said, "Well, I want you to bring me a urine specimen, and I want you to bring me a defecation specimen, and I want you to bring me a semen specimen." Now, as they started out the door, you know, Bob can't hear too good, and he turned to Ruth, and he said, "What was it that he wanted me to bring next week?" And she said, "He wants you to bring your underwear when you come back." Now, for you younger guys, that doesn't make much sense. But for we older fellas, it begins to make a little sense. It's easily understood. This is a great weekend. I think I've had more fun and more pleasure the last couple of days just getting to sit and listen to other people speak and getting to watch the various different members of AA, Al-Anon, and Alateen that are here. And I've really had a good, fun, enjoyable weekend. One thing I've enjoyed about it seems as though this whole weekend has been pretty well keyed in on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think anywhere I'm around listening to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it always makes me feel better. And we've heard over and over and over this weekend about the fact that the steps are pretty well written in a certain sequence, that they are designed to bring about certain things in our lives. And I think through listening to the other speakers, we've been able to see that we are powerless over alcohol and our lives have become unmanageable. And I think it's pretty easy for us to see the reason we're powerless over alcohol is because we have an illness. And it's an illness of both the body and also of the mind. And we've heard it repeatedly said this weekend, part of that illness is a physical allergy of the body that ensures whenever we take a drink, it triggers an actual craving within our body that demands more of the same. And that craving is so strong that after we once started drinking, we simply cannot stop drinking. So therefore, we're unable to drink safely because of our physical allergy, the abnormal reaction to alcohol. We've heard it said over and over this weekend that part of our illness lies within our mind, the inability to differentiate the truth from the false, the inability to see the truth about alcohol. And always we alcoholics, just before we drink, we believe that it's going to be okay. In our search for a sense of ease and comfort, for that great thing that the first couple of drinks gives to us, invariably our mind cons us into believing something that isn't true. We believe that this time we'll have two drinks, everything will be okay, we won't get drunk. And based on a lie, we take a couple of drinks, really expecting to get only that great sense of ease and comfort. But after we take the two drinks, that triggers the allergy, then we can't stop and we end up drunk all over again. So we really can't safely drink because of the body, nor can we manage to stay sober because of the mind. And if we can't drink and we can't stay sober, then surely we have become powerless over alcohol. And if we drink it long enough, then sooner or later our life is going to become unmanageable. No doubt about that at all. And I think we've been able to see that. We've been able to hear that all weekend. In the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, in the first part of the book, in the doctor's opinion, in Bill's story, in chapter 2 and chapter 3, we see information that brings those things out to us to help us understand what our problem really is. Now, if we're powerless over alcohol, then evidently the answer to that or the solution to that is going to have to be in power. And we find that we can do nothing about the body, so it's going to have to be power working through the mind. We can do nothing about the physical allergy, but we might be able to do something about the obsession of the mind. And again, as we read Bill's story, doctor's opinion, Bill's story, chapters 1, 2, and 3, we begin to see that there maybe there is a power greater than we are that can restore us to sanity. That maybe there is a way of living where we can be sober and find some peace of mind and serenity and happiness. And if we can be sober and find some peace of mind, serenity, and happiness, then it's not necessary for us to take a couple of drinks in order to find that great sense of ease and comfort. If we can find that sense of ease and comfort and sobriety at the same time, then our obsession of the mind is not going to tell us the lie. It's not going to tell us that it's okay to drink. But we also find through those chapters, if we don't find this power, that we're going to remain restless, irritable, and discontented. And we're going to be filled with shame, fear, guilt, and remorse. And we run around sober and we're not feeling good, and eventually, wanting to feel better, the mind will begin to remember the first couple of drinks. Not the 20th drink. Not the jailhouse, not the hospital, not the car wreck, but the sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a couple of drinks and eventually takes us right back into drinking. And the book warns us over and over and over and over again. Without this power greater than we are, we're going to be unable to find that kind of living. And if we don't find that good peace of mind, serenity, and happiness and sobriety at the same time, then eventually that drives us right back into drinking again. Thank God for the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we're the only alcoholics in the world that know what's wrong with us. All the other alcoholics that are out there drinking, they don't know what's wrong with them. They think it's a matter of willpower. They think it's moral character. They think it's sin. Thank God we've been allowed to find in AA what's really wrong with us. Another thing we've heard over and over all weekend is this thing dealing with this power greater than we are, or this problem that most of us have had with the idea of accepting the power, or the power called God, in our lives. And I think mainly one of the main reasons we've had trouble accepting that power is because old conceptions of that power. And many of us thought that God was purely hellfire and brimstone, and that he wouldn't have anything to do with us because of what we had been in the first place. And that even if he could remove the sanity, he wouldn't do it for us. Thank God Bill Wilson was a real alcoholic. Bill understood people like us. He understood how we think. He understood our ideas. He understood our prejudices and our aversions to things spiritual. Bill was just like us. And thank God he wrote the chapter in the big book called We Agnostics. Because through that chapter, we were allowed to get some new ideas about this power greater than we are. We were allowed to find out that the finding of the power or the search for God is really not going to be too difficult if we're willing to do certain things. And we found that we didn't have to believe anything. We didn't have to know anything. We didn't have to have any faith in anything. The only thing we had to be able to believe was that there is a power greater than human power. And I don't think I've ever seen a human being yet, atheist or agnostic, that's not willing to concede there is some kind of power greater than human power. And we found in that chapter that if we could start the search for believing, that we would follow a certain procedure, and through that procedure we would find that power greater than we are. And to my great, great amazement, I found that that power dwelled within me. You know, and that's one of the greatest things I've ever learned about spirituality. Is God is not necessarily out there somewhere. And He's not necessarily standing on the cloud holding a big stick ready to zap me every time I do something wrong. That God dwells within me. And if He dwells within me, He becomes a personal God of my understanding. And based on that chapter, changing my views about God and changing my understanding about God, then I found that I could make a decision regarding that power greater than I am. You know, in the big book in chapter 5 starts really with step 3. And it talks about making a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understand Him. And based on old ideas, based on the old thoughts that I had about God, there's no way I could have made that decision. I wasn't about to turn my will and my life over to the care of hellfire and brimstone. Thank God for chapter 4 in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And that brings us really to the point where we are now. You know, if we've been able to be convinced of the three pertinent ideas that it talks about and how it works, if we've been able to see where we are powerless over alcohol and our lives have become unmanageable, and if we've been able to see that there is a power greater than ourselves that can restore us to sanity, then we're going to have to make a decision regarding that power. And our book tells us over and over and over, we have but one of two alternatives. One is to stay powerless, go on drinking to the bitter end until we die from alcoholism. And the other is to accept spiritual help. And when we're faced with those two alternatives, we're really looking at 1 and 2. Stay powerless or accept the power. And then in step 3, we're asked to make a decision between those two things. Do I want to stay powerless or do I want the power? And thank God through the information in the book. And thank God through drinking enough alcohol long enough and suffering enough pain, I was able to make that decision. And I think if we're going to talk about step 4 today, we need to look just a little bit at step 3. We need to talk about step 3 for just a few minutes, because I think the full understanding of step 3 really determines what we're going to do in step 4. And really determines how difficult step 4 is going to be. And as we look at step 3, where we make the decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understand Him, I think there's certain words within that step that we need to look at to try to perhaps get the same meaning or the same idea about those words that Bill Wilson himself had. You know, if the big book Alcoholics Anonymous is a textbook, and I'm convinced that it is, and if the purpose of a textbook is to transfer information from the mind of one human being, the writer of the book, through the written word to the mind of another human being, increasing the knowledge of the user of the book, and I really believe that's what textbooks are for, then it stands to reason the transfer of information is going to be based upon the understanding of the words that are used in the book. And if the writer uses a word and has a certain understanding of it, and the reader reads that word and has a different understanding, then naturally the information that comes through is going to be garbled information. And I think there's a few key words in the big book that if we don't really understand them more or less as the writer did, it's going to give us difficulty. And I think one of the most misunderstood and most overlooked words in the entire 12-step program is the word decision. So step 3 says we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand Him. And I hear a lot of people today in AA say, well, I've been in 6 years, and my life's still all screwed up, and I don't understand why, because I turned it over to God 4 years ago when I took step 3. No, we don't turn it over to God in step 3. We make a decision to turn it over to God in step 3. And the word decision itself implies that there's going to have to be some further action to carry out this decision. You know, one of the best examples I can think of is some years ago, my wife Barbara and I made a decision in the fall of the year to go to California. And we were going to go to Los Angeles and visit some relatives. But we didn't do anything about that decision. And the end result is that year we didn't get to California. Now the second year, the following year, we made the same decision about the fall of the year. And again, we didn't do anything about it, so we didn't get to California. And the third year in a row, my feet got itchy again in the fall of the year. And we made the decision to go to Los Angeles and visit our relatives. But this time it was a little different. This time I took the car down and had it serviced. Barbara packed some food and clothes, and we got in her automobile, and we drove from our home to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Then we drove to Oklahoma City. Then we drove to Amarillo, Texas. Then we drove to Albuquerque, New Mexico, Flagstaff, Arizona, Barstow, California, San Bernardino, and you know, by golly, one day we ended up in Los Angeles visiting with our relatives. Not because we made a decision, because we took the action necessary to carry out that decision. The other two words in that step I think is very important. One is the word will. That's what we're deciding to turn over. And people seem to get confused from time to time by what we mean by the word will. Will is nothing more than our thinking apparatus. Will is nothing more than our mind. Will is nothing more than this thing that we have up there in our head which tells us what to do. A perfect example of the use of the word will. It's after beginning to approach the end of my life and I've gathered up a few material things and I become worried about what's going to happen to those things after I pass on. Well, I may go down to an attorney and sit down with that attorney and say, now look, when I kick the bucket, I'd like for this to go to my spouse and I want this to go to my son. This is to be my daughter's. I want my brother to have this. Now that attorney will take my thinking as of that day and write it down on a piece of paper. And I'll sign it, and maybe the attorney will sign it as a witness, and we put it in the safe. 3 or 4 years later, I kick the bucket. And if my family's like most families, they'll call up the undertaker and say, come and get him. Let's get him out to the graveyard as soon as we can. And they run me out to the graveyard, and they bury me, and they say, now let's go back to that attorney's office. And they go back to that attorney's office, and he gets that piece of paper out of that safe, and he reads to them what my thinking was 4 or 5 years ago when I was sitting there in that office. Now, we know that they call that piece of paper a will. It's not by accident. Will, thinking, mind are all synonymous. They mean basically the same thing. So what I'm really making a decision to do is turn my will over to the care, and that step originally said in the original manuscript, and direction of God as I understand Him. Now, in addition to turning my will over, making the decision to do so, what else am I going to try to turn over? Well, I'm making a decision to turn my life over to the care and direction of God as I understand Him. And what is my life? Well, my life is nothing more than my actions. What I am today, right now, as of this moment, standing behind this podium, is the sum accumulative total of all the actions that I've taken throughout my lifetime has made my life what it is today. Now, all action is born in thought. Let's say that again. All action is born in thought. Now, sometimes we react to things so fast that we think we do it automatically. We really don't. It's impossible for my body to reach out and take this cup and take it up to my lips and take a drink out of it without my mind telling my body to do so. Now, when I first came to AA, I was very, very concerned about step 3. And I remember going to my sponsor and I said, I don't believe I can take step 3. He said, why? And I said, well, if I turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him, I don't know what He'll have me be. And He may want me to be a missionary. And He may send me to Africa or China or somewhere like that. And I sure as hell don't want to do that. And he just laughed and he said, well, let's look at it this way. He said, at least it wouldn't be in the hands of an idiot, would it? He said, let's look back through your lifetime. He said, you've always been a selfish, self-centered, self-willed human being. He said, you've never paid any attention to what other people wanted, what God wanted, or anything else. You've always done exactly what you wanted to do whenever you wanted to do it, and to hell with the rest of them. And he said, the end result is, living a life run on self-will, you have absolutely destroyed your life and the life of everybody around you that cares anything about you. He said, just think. If God could direct your thinking, it might become better. And he said, if your thinking becomes better, then maybe your actions would become better. And he said, if your actions become better, then maybe your life and the life of all those around you who care for you might become better also. But he said, Charlie, left on your own resources, you simply do not stand the chance. Because he said, left on your own resources, you'll always do the same things you've always done. And you'll end up hurting people. And then those people are going to retaliate against you. And then you're going to resent the hell out of them. And you're going to be scared to death of what they're going to do to you. And you're going to be filled with shame, fear, guilt, and remorse. And he said, that kind of thinking keeps you from having any peace of mind, serenity, and happiness. And he said, under those conditions, without peace of mind, serenity, and happiness, sooner or later your mind will return you right back to the idea of taking a drink in order to feel better. And he said, if you don't do something about self-will, then you'll never be able to stay sober. Now, in looking at self-will, and we got a little picture or two we're going to use up here on the screen, and you'll have a handout for it, and Ken's going to kind of work with me off and on here. And let's take a look at a little chart, the thing that really creates self, or the thing that causes self-will. 13 years after Bill Wilson wrote the big book, they prevailed upon him to write another book, and it was called The 12 and 12. Now, Bill, I'm sure, had several reasons and several ideas behind the writing of The 12 and 12. One is that he wanted and needed a vehicle to be able to carry the traditions which he had just really got the fellowship to approve. And he thought, I can put the steps and the traditions in the same book. But I think another reason Bill consented to writing the 12 and 12 is he could see that in the big book, when he wrote it in 1939, 37, 38, 39, that there were several things that he really didn't know and didn't understand back in the 30s. You know, Bill was not a person trained to work with other people. Bill did not know a whole lot about spiritual nature. Bill was not one who knew very much about human nature back in the 1930s. Bill was a New York City stock speculator. Bill was a night school lawyer. And he was very adept at making his living by selling fast talking to slow thinking people. And he sat down and he wrote a book that's one of the greatest books the world's ever seen. Surely, as we've heard all weekend, God had something to do with that also. But Bill could realize that by 1952, that maybe we needed some better or more complete information to better be able to work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in the 12 and 12, he wrote what he always referred to as a series of essays, not to replace the big book Alcoholics Anonymous, but to add to the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. And as you read the 12 and 12 and study the steps in there, you'll find there's no directions in there on how to work the steps. The only directions on how to work the steps are in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. But there's some additional information in the 12 and 12 that's not in the big book, that if we can pick it up and read it and understand it, then it makes it much simpler and much easier to follow the directions in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, on the first two pages of chapter or step 4 in the 12 and 12, Bill taught me in just a few words more about myself and more about what makes me tick than I had learned in my entire lifetime. He talked about what called the three basic instincts of life. And he said that all human beings are born with these three basic instincts of life, that they are God-given, and that they are absolutely necessary for survival of the human race. He talked about this thing called the social instinct, this desire for we human beings to come together in groups. And he said if we didn't have that desire, if we cared nothing about each other, and if we all went our individual ways, that sooner or later the world would go into complete anarchy, a dog-eat-dog situation would arrive, and sooner or later, under those conditions, the human race would simply fail to survive. And on a chart, he shows us several words that he used in talking about this. You know, he talked about this thing called self-esteem. Nothing more than what we think of ourselves, based primarily on what we think other people think of us. He talked about this thing called companionship. He talked about this thing called prestige. He talked about this thing called pride. And he said all of those things stem from this social instinct or this desire to be liked and be accepted and be respected by other people. Now, if you want to be liked and accepted and respected by other people, the first thing you got to do is find out, well, what is it other people want from me? You know, usually we're taught that as kids growing up. Society teaches us those things as we grow up. And based on what they teach us, we make decisions on what we want to be. And it'll vary in different parts of the world. One part of the world, it may be to have a good education. Another part of the world, to be a large landowner. Another part of the world, to have a large family. Whatever we're taught and whatever we decide, we set goals. And as we grow up from children and start becoming adults, and we begin to work toward those goals, we go to college, we do this, we do those things to successfully complete those goals. And I don't think you and I would do the work necessary to complete that goal, nor would we make the sacrifices necessary to complete the goal if we didn't get a reward for that. And the great reward we human beings get for doing that kind of work is the praise that we get at the moment of successful completion of the goal. You know, how many of us have set the goal and worked toward it for years, and finally we get there and they pat us on the back and they say, oh my God, you're great, you're doing fine, you're really something else. And there's a feeling that comes over us which really is indescribably wonderful. And the only thing wrong with it, though, it doesn't seem to last very long. We no sooner reach that goal than we look around and we say, is this all there is to it? And that causes us to set another goal. And we work and we work and we strive and we strive, and we reach the new goal. We get the praise, we get the prestige, and we love it, but it doesn't last long, and we set another goal. And it seems to create within we human beings an insatiable desire for more recognition, for more power, for more prestige. And we don't get there fast enough, and they're not giving it to us like we think they ought to, so we start taking shortcuts. And we start doing a little lying and a little conning and a little manipulating and stepping on people's toes. And we do that, we hurt other people. Then they in turn retaliate against us and create pain and suffering for us. The Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous says it's plain that a life run on self-will can hardly ever be a success, because under those conditions we're always in collision with people, places, and things. Bill talks about the security instinct. He said all human beings are born with a desire to be secure in the future, because without that desire, we would not do the things necessary to be secure in the future. And we wouldn't put away the food, we wouldn't provide the shelter, and the next winter season comes along, we would just simply freeze to death, and the next drought season, we would starve to death. And he said all human beings are born with that desire. Now, I know in AA we live one day at a time. But also know that everybody in this room's got an insurance policy. And the purpose of that insurance policy is to secure ourselves in the future. That is a basic God-given instinct, and it must be a good thing. Now, if we're going to be secure, we're going to have to also decide, well, what is it that we need to be secure? And that's going to vary in different parts of the world, and that's usually taught to us by society. One part of the world, you only got to have $4. Another part of the world, you need $4,000. Another part of the world, you need 4 million. Another part of the world, you need 172 coconuts, or whatever it is that they use to measure their security by. And based on what society teaches us, we set a goal, and we work, and we work, and we strive, and we strive, and we sacrifice. You know, you can't be secure in the future and be a bum today. You're going to have to work and take your money and invest it, and etc. You can't be secure in the future and blow everything you have today. And I don't think we would do the work necessary to make the sacrifices necessary to be secure in the future if we didn't get a reward for that. And the reward is the great feeling that we get at the moment of successful completion of the goal. How many of us have set that goal for the new suit, for the new dress, for the new car, for the new couch, for the new home, and we literally work our tails off to get it. And the day it becomes ours and nobody can take it away from us, we get a feeling which is indescribably wonderful. Christ, we make the last final payment on the home, and we call in the neighbors, and we celebrate, and we have a party, and we burn the mortgage. It's such a great feeling. One thing wrong with it, though, it doesn't last very long. It's just a temporary feeling. Well, no sooner we get it paid for than we look around, and hell, her house is bigger than mine. He's driving a Cadillac, and I'm still in a Chevrolet. He's got a Brooks Brothers suit, and I bought mine at Kmart's. And that caused us to set another goal. And we work and we work and we strive and we strive and we sacrifice and we reach the new goal and it feels good, but it doesn't last long. And we set another goal, and it seems to create within we human beings an insatiable desire for more and more and more and more of these material things. And we're not getting them fast enough, and they're not giving them to us like we think they ought to. So we start taking a few shortcuts. We lie a little bit. We con, we cheat, we manipulate. And the instant we do, we hurt other people. And they in turn retaliate against us and create pain and suffering for us. It's plain that a life run on self-will can hardly ever be a success. Under those conditions, we're always in collision with people, places, and things. The third basic instinct Bill talks about is the sex instinct. Now, I know in AA, we talk about sex a lot. We laugh about it. We tell stories about it. I doubt if any of us really know a hell of a lot about it. But Bill says all human beings are born with a desire to have sex. And he said if we didn't have that desire, we would not have sex. And if we didn't have sex, we could not reproduce ourselves. And he said if we don't reproduce ourselves, sooner or later the human race is going to fail to survive. So all human beings are born with a desire to have sex. Now, it may get turned off by bad happenings, bad teachings, and various other different things, but in the beginning, we're all born with that desire. Now, if we're going to successfully reproduce ourselves through the sexual act, you know, I think we're going to have to work at it. Hell, you can do more work in 3 minutes of sex than you'll do all day digging a ditch. You older fellas remember how it used to be when we got through with it? My God, you fall over sideways, the sweat's just pouring off of you, you can hardly get your breath, you feel like you've died, gone to heaven, come back two or three times, and I don't think we would do that kind of work if we didn't get a reward for doing so. And the reward we get is that great feeling, both physically and emotionally, at the moment of successful completion of the sex act. There really is no, and there's not another feeling like it anywhere in the world. But also, just like the other two, it's just a temporary feeling. Hey, you no sooner get through with doing it than you get to thinking about doing it again. Next thing you know, it's such an exciting and pleasurable thing, we get to thinking about doing it in different ways. And then we get to thinking about doing it in different positions. And then we get to thinking about doing it with different people. And the next thing you know, we find ourselves doing it at the wrong time, in the wrong place, in the wrong way, with the wrong people. And the instant we do so, we hurt other people. And they retaliate against us and create pain and suffering for us. It's plain that a life run on self-will can hardly ever be a success. Under those conditions, the very things that God gives us, which makes it necessary for survival of the human race, turn out to be very, very things that will destroy us in the long run, left on self-will. Now, if all human beings in the world today could fulfill the three basic instincts of life at the level that God intended, there would be no conflict in the world today. But the only problem with all human beings is everybody has self-will. And everybody displays self-will from time to time. And everybody does things that are against God's will, against other people's will, with the end result that they are continually harming other people. Now, if we try to run our life on self-will, then we're going to be absolutely robbed of any peace of mind, serenity, and happiness. We're going to be restless, irritable, and discontented. We're going to be filled with shame, fear, guilt, and remorse. We're never going to feel satisfied. Now, coming out of that little chart, at the bottom of it, we see another circle called wrongs, which is another word that we need to look at. somewhere in AA, we got the idea that the wrongs that we're going to discuss with another human being in step five is a list of dirty, filthy, nasty things. But if you go to the dictionary and look up the word wrongs, you'll find several definitions for it. One definition of the word wrong is incorrect judgment of others. And we're going to find out a little bit later on that's exactly what a resentment is. Another definition of the word wrong is incorrect believing, and we're going to find a little later on that's what most of our fears are. Another definition of the word wrong is incorrect acting that harms other people. And we're going to find a little later on that's where our guilt and remorse comes from. All selfish, self-centered people who operate on self-will only will always display these three common manifestations of self-will. If you want to spot a selfish, self-centered, self-willed human being, it isn't easy. I mean, it isn't hard. A selfish, self-centered human being is always madder than hell. Damn him and damn her, and by God, I'll show them, and they're not going to treat me that way, and blah de blah blah blah, just literally eaten up and filled with anger. A selfish, self-centered human being is always filled with fear. Can't depend on God, can't depend on other people, and if you're a practicing alcoholic and you're reaching the end of the road, you can't depend on yourself anymore, and you have no idea what's going to happen tomorrow, and you've got to be running scared to death. A selfish, self-centered human being, because of the three basic instincts of life, will always overdo in that area and end up hurting other people. And if God dwells within us, we know the difference between right and wrong. And as we hurt other people, then we begin to be filled with guilt and remorse and fear associated with what they're going to do when they find out. The very things that God gives us for our survival, left on self-will, are the very things that destroy us in the long run. You know, I kind of like to refer to those things as the utilities of life. This building we're in this afternoon is a beautiful building. This building that we're in this afternoon is a very useful building. This building we're in this afternoon has three basic utilities. Some kind of light or electricity. It's got second, some kind of heat or cooling system. And it's got third, some kind of water system in it. Now, this building would be absolutely useless if it didn't have those three utilities in it. But almost invariably, the very thing that will destroy this building will be at least one of those three utilities if they get out of control. And our basic instincts of life are the same things. The very things that make us useful and make us whole and make us human beings are the very things left on our own resources that will get out of control and destroy us, just like these utilities would destroy this building. And when I could once see that and could once understand that, then I could really see why I need to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him. Because without that decision and without the action necessary to turn it over, then I'm going to continue to operate on self-will. And that's going to rob me of any possibility of peace of mind. And we want to feel good and rob the peace of mind, our mind will invariably, according to Dr. Silkworth, turn back to that sense of ease and comfort that comes by taking the first two drinks. Not the car wreck after 20 drinks. Not the hospital, not the jailhouse, but the great feeling that comes from the first two drinks. And then we take a drink based on the lie, then we trigger the allergy, then we can't stop. Now if we go into the big book, let me turn it off for a while. Now if we go into the big book at the end of step three, knowing and understanding a few of these things, I think it'll be much simpler and much easier for us to be able to start looking at this thing called step four. At the bottom of page 63, the big book says, next we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us have never attempted. Though our decision, referring to step three, was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and to be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. And one thing I always love to look at in that little paragraph is how long are you supposed to wait after you take step three, before you take step four? And we hear all kind of ideas about that in AA. Not too long ago, we heard one of these so-called professionals in the field counseling people to wait a minimum of 2 years before you take step four. And our question to that person was, how many people have you killed with that statement? You see, we're trying to find a little peace of mind, serenity, and happiness. We're trying to get rid of the guilt and the remorse and the restlessness and the irritability. And every day that we procrastinate and put off step four is a day that we're going to remain that way. And every day we remain that way is a day that we're one day closer to taking a drink of alcohol. And I really don't know how many days I could go. And frankly, I'm not very interested in finding out. Bill tells us that step three will have little permanent effect unless at once followed by the strenuous effort to face and be rid of those things in ourselves which have been blocking us. In other words, step four should come immediately after step three. Now, why won't we do that? Now, I think a lot of reasons we won't do that. One reason we won't do that is some of we older members of AA tend to play king off of the mountain with step four. And we tend to tell the newcomer how tough it is, and by God, you just wait till you get to step four, and blah-de-blah. And we just literally scare them to death. And based on fear, they refuse to do step four. Well, let me say this afternoon, if we would do step four the way the big book says to do it, there's really nothing to be afraid of, period. Another reason we don't do step four is because the instructions in the big book on how to do it are so short and simple that we alcoholics, with our intellectual complicated minds, looking for something more difficult to do, have absolutely overlooked the simplicity of the directions in the book on how to do it. And not understanding how to do it, then we search for another way. And somebody read in step five a statement that said something about all your life story. And we said, oh, that must be what they want us to do in step four, write all our life story. And many of us did that. I did in the beginning. Now, I don't know how important my life story was to other people, but it must have been pretty important to me because I had about 97 pages in it. And I took it to another human being, and he read it and said, not very pretty, is it? And I said, no, and he threw it in a wastebasket, and he said, you'll never have to be that way again. And I didn't learn anything new from that at all. Because you see, everything I wrote down, I already knew. So I learned nothing new by the writing of it, my life story. And today I fully, completely recognize that 95% of my life story has nothing to do with my drinking anyhow. The fact I was born in 1929, I don't think that's got a hell of a lot to do with my alcoholism. Might have caused the stock market crash. I don't know, but it had nothing to do with my alcoholism. The fact that I graduated from high school in Tulsa, Oklahoma, I don't think it's got anything to do with my alcoholism. The fact that I was married when I was 21 years old, I don't think that's got anything to do with my alcoholism. But I'll tell you what it did do. The 95% that had nothing to do with it very effectively covered up the 5% that did. And I learned nothing about my alcoholism from writing my life story that I didn't already know before I wrote it. So in our desperation, in our confusion, then somebody in Minneapolis, Minnesota wrote a four-step inventory guide. And we got hold of that guide and we combined it with the big book and we tried to use them both and we got more confused. Then somebody in Dallas, Texas wrote a four-step inventory guide. And we took the Dallas guide and the Minneapolis guide and combined them both with the big book and got in worse shape yet. I have no idea how many inventory guides are floating around the country today. I saw one not too long ago that had 26 pages in it. And I'll guarantee you, if you wasn't crazy as hell before you took it, you would be when you got through with it. It was one of those kind. And all the time, the instructions have been in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think in order for us to see them, in order for us to understand them, we've got to understand a little bit about this guy named Bill Wilson. Now, I know that everybody says Bill and Dr. Bob wrote the big book. Dr. Bob looked at what Bill wrote. Bill wrote the book, really. And all the other people got to look at it and make changes to it. But Bill was the primary author of the book. And Bill Wilson did two things that most writers do. I don't know whether he knew it automatically or whether somebody taught him that or what. But two things that Bill has done all the way through the book, and if you can ever really key into it, it'll make the book easier to understand. One thing that Bill has done all the way through this book is he, in trying to teach us something, he never repeats himself using the same words twice. When he wants to repeat himself, and all writers repeat themselves over and over, and when they want to do that, they will go find another word that means basically the same thing as the word they used in the beginning. And people used to ask Bill about that, and we've known two ladies that work with and for Bill for years that both say the same thing, that Bill would kind of rear back and say, well, when they taught me English and writing courses in college, they taught me not to use the same words over and over because that shows how dumb you really are. He said, we have simply found different words meaning the same thing. And if we can see that, it's going to make it a lot easier to understand this. The other thing that Bill did that most good writers do, they usually talk to us about something that we already know about and then use what we know to teach us something new. You know, there was another great teacher that did that a couple thousand years ago, and he was really good at it. When he wanted to teach something to the fisherman, he simply told him a story about fish, knowing the fisherman would understand it. Now, if he wanted to teach the same thing to the shepherd, he changed his story, and this time it became about sheep, and the shepherd would understand it. And then when he wanted to teach it to the farmer, the story became about cattle and grains, knowing that the farmer would understand it. All teachers do that, and all writers do that. Now, Bill, throughout the big book in various places, talks to us about things we know about. And one of the examples that comes to mind almost immediately is on the first page of chapter 2 when he talks about the great ocean liner the moment after rescue from shipwreck. In 1939, the ocean liners were the normal mode of travel from one continent to another. And Bill knew that in talking about the ocean liner, we would understand what he's talking about. In 1939, the Titanic was still fresh on everybody's mind, and Bill knew that they would understand when he talked about the great ocean liner the moment after shipwreck, using what we know to teach us something new. He's going to do the same thing on page 64 in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. He's going to talk to us about a business inventory. Assuming that we know something about a business inventory. And then he's going to tell us to do the same thing with our lives. And if we can once see what he's doing, I think it's going to make it much, much simpler and easier to understand how to do step four. He says, therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. We're on page 64, first paragraph. This was step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. And I think he's made his first valid comparison. He talked about a personal inventory in the first sentence. Then he jumps immediately to a business inventory. And he says a business inventory which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. If you and I had a business, and let's say it's selling ladies' purses or men's watches or bicycles or whatever, if we didn't inventory that business once in a while, we would have no idea where we stand. We wouldn't know what's been stolen out of our store we didn't get paid for. We wouldn't know what we've sold and we need to reorder to put stuff back in stock. We wouldn't know what's become damaged and unsaleable and nobody wants to buy them, so we need to put them on sale and get rid of them. We wouldn't know what's become out of style, and it just sits there in the store day after day after day, taking up valuable shelf space, and we're probably paying interest on borrowed money to buy it in the first place. And if we had a business like that and we didn't inventory that business, sooner or later under those conditions, we would probably go broke. Well, I think you and I have one of the greatest, most important businesses in the world. In our personal lives, we have a business of staying sober. We have a business of trying to find a way to live where we can be peaceful, happy, and free. We have a business of trying to find a way to live so we don't have to go back to drinking. And if we don't inventory in our personal business of staying sober, chances are we're going to go broke too, and going broke for us is to go back to drinking again. So I think his first valid comparison is business or personal. Without it, we're probably going to go broke. Now he begins to describe to us how to take a business inventory. And again, we have another sheet, and I'll ask Ken to put it on the screen. And I think you have one that more or less matches it. And we're going to take a few key words out of the big book. Deborah Hudson, please call home. Deborah Hudson, please call home. Bill says, taking a commercial inventory. Now, Dad Burnham, see, here he is again using different words. He called it a business inventory, but now he calls it a commercial inventory. I don't know what else he learned in college, but he sure as hell learned not to use the same words over and over. He says, taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding. And we've taken the words fact-finding out of there and we've put it on the business side of the sheet. And a fact-facing process, and we've put fact-facing on the business side of the sheet. It's an effort to discover the truth, and we've taken truth out of there and put it on the business side of the sheet. About the stock in trade, and we've put stock in trade on the business side of the sheet. Now, stock in trade, that's the items that are in the store for sale. That's the ladies' purses, the men's watches, the bicycles, or whatever. Now, one object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods. So we put damaged or unsaleable goods under business. And to get rid of them promptly and without regret. And we put promptly and without regret under the business. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. And the owner's going to have to be truthful with himself. You know, he may tend to say, well, the reason those ladies don't buy those purses is because they just don't really understand what they need, and I believe I'll hold them a little longer. And if he does, it's going to cost him money when he does that. So we've simply taken a few key words out of his business inventory, put it on the right-hand side of the sheet. Now, what we're trying to find is the stock in trade that's damaged and unsaleable that we want to get out of that store. I don't think there's a soul in this room would have any trouble with seeing that or accepting that. Now, this guy, in comparing words, we believe that he took words that mean the same thing and wrote step four with them. And we're going to take those words out of step four and put them on the left-hand side of the sheet under personal inventory. And step four says, we made a searching. And I believe we'll find that searching and fact-finding mean basically the same thing. To find the facts, to search out the facts. We made a searching and fearless. And we're putting fearless straight across from fact-facing. I think we'll find they mean basically the same thing. To fearlessly look to facts, to face the facts as they are. We made a searching and fearless moral. And I think that's where we got in trouble. We said, oh crap. There it is. There's that list of dirty, filthy, nasty items, and we don't want to look at them. We don't want anybody else to see them. Now, I'm not sure what all Bill Wilson knew, but I'm convinced of one thing, that Bill Wilson understood the English language. And I believe if he'd wanted you and I to make a list of dirty, filthy, nasty items, I think he would have said we made a searching and fearless amoral or immoral inventory. He didn't say that. He said moral. And this bothered the hell out of me. Until finally one day I went to the dictionary and looked it up. And moral simply means truth. Moral is the right and wrong of any given situation. Moral is the truth of the facts as they are. Moral and truth means identically the same thing. We made a searching and fearless moral inventory of what? Of ourselves. We are the only stock in trade that we have in this business of staying sober. Nobody can make us sober. Nobody can make us drink. Oh, I agree that they can make us thirsty as hell. But they cannot make us drink. We're the only stock in trade we have in this business of staying sober. Now, my book tells me over and over and over that the real problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. The fact that I'm physically allergic to alcohol is beside the point if I don't take the first drink. And my book tells me over and over that just before I take the first drink, I believe something that isn't true. I believe that I can drink. And it says, therefore, the real problem the alcoholic centers in the mind rather than the body. Now, whether I succeed or not in my business of staying sober is going to depend upon how I think. How many times have we heard the saying, stinking thinking leads to drinking. If my thinking is okay today, chances are I'm going to be sober tomorrow. If my thinking is lousy today, if it's restless, irritable, and discontented, if it's filled with anger, if it's filled with guilt, if it's filled with remorse, chances are I'm probably going to get drunk tomorrow. So my stock in trade is going to be myself, and the part of me that I'm going to inventory is this thing right up here in my head to see how I'm thinking. Now, God's thinking is peace of mind, serenity, and happiness. God's thinking is love, patience, tolerance, and goodwill. And if I've got a mind that's already filled with other kinds of thinking, then I've got my shells filled with damaged and unsaleable goods. And in order for God's thinking to come in and direct my mind, I'm going to have to do something about finding those things and removing them, because they're what blocks me off from God's will. Now, there's three common manifestations of self. Our book tells us that we are physically ill, we're mentally ill, and we're spiritually ill. And it says when a spiritual illness is overcome, then we straighten out mentally and physically. You know, there's only one or three ways a human being can be sick. You can be sick physically, and for that you go to a medical doctor. And your physical sickness will display certain symptoms. The doctor will read them, diagnose, prescribe, and hopefully you get well. You can also be mentally ill. For that, you'd go to a psychologist or a psychiatrist. Your mental illness will display certain symptoms. The psychiatrist will read them, diagnose, prescribe, and hopefully you get well. Now, the only other way you can be sick as a human being is to be spiritually sick. And a spiritually ill human being is one that cannot receive God's will and power in their lives. And spiritual illness displays certain symptoms also. We looked at them on that last chart we looked at. The three wrongs that come from self. Resentment, fear, and guilt and remorse associated with the harms we've done to people in the past. If our mind is filled with that, then God cannot get in there. You know, I like to look at my head as just a little bitty store. Not a very big one. A little Quick Trip, Handy Stop, Circle K, but not very big. And in my store up here, I've got some display cases. And over here on the left-hand side of my store, these display cases are filled with resentments. Damn her. Damn him. By God, I'll show them. And they're not going to treat me that way. And blah, God can't get in there. Those cases are already filled with resentments. Over here on this side of my store, I've got a storage cabinet, and it's filled with fear. Oh, my God, what's she going to do when she finds out? Oh, my God, what's going to happen when the check hits the bank? Oh, my God, what's going to happen when the boss finds out about it? Oh, my. And that part of my mind's already filled. God can't get in there. It's already full. Back here in the back of my store, I've got a storage room, and it's filled with guilt and remorse. If God dwells within me, and my book says He does, and I know the difference between right and wrong, when I hurt other people, I know it, and it gnaws on me, and it's filled up that storage room completely, and I'm scared to death of what they're going to do when they find out, and God can't get in that room either. He's completely blocked out of there because of those three common manifestations of self. Now, if I want God to direct my thinking, then I'm going to have to do something about the removal of those three things. And if I can get those removed, then God's thinking, love, patience, tolerance, and goodwill can come in and replace the damaged and unsaleable goods, and my mind will be filled with good stock in trade. Such a simple thing. I'm amazed. It took me 15 years to see this. And you know the day I saw it? I was sitting on the toilet stool. Thinking. Sitting on a toilet stool thinking. And one day, page 64 jumped in my mind, and it was just as clear as a bell that Bill had used his words comparing the personal inventory and the business inventory, and he had used his words to tell us what we're going to have to get rid of. Now, if we could get rid of those, and if we could keep them from coming back, then God's thinking can enter our mind and fill those spaces up where we've removed those things. Now, you can't do anything about a problem till you see the problem. So the first thing we got to do about these three things, resentment, fear, and harms done to others, is put them on paper so we can look at them. The problem with people trying to take the inventory in their head is you can just see one thing at a time in your head. And we'll never see what resentments do to us, what fear does to us, what guilt and remorse does to us, until we get them down on a piece of paper and take a look at them. And I find today that this is nothing new. You know, people have been writing down what's wrong with them for centuries. I just didn't know they were doing that. Today I find out that it's been done for thousands of years. Let's look at Bill's words. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. In other words, we're going to do with our lives what he just told us to do with the business inventory. We took stock honestly, morally, truthfully. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup. Now, we're not going to look at assets. I'm sorry, that's just the way it is. We're not going to look at assets. Assets don't cause you to go broke. The good items in stock, the saleable items, those that people are buying and we're replacing them and we're making money, though, they don't cause us to go broke. What causes us to go broke is the bad items in stock. So we're going to search out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. Being convinced that self manifested in various ways what defeated us, we considered its common manifestations, and we've looked at them. Resentment, fear, harms done to others. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From its stem, all forms of spiritual disease, for we've been not only mentally and physically ill, we've been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. Now, I think we need to look just a little bit at the word resentment as to what it is, what it really means. And that word resentment is made up of two old words. One of them is the word R-E. And R-E means to do again, to play again, to feel again, to do over again. Anytime you see R-E on the front of a word, it means to do it again. Repaint, replay, redo. The second half of that word is from an old, old word called sentire. And sentire means to feel. So the word resentment itself means to re-feel. Now, let's look at what we do with this thing. As we go through life, everybody, remember, everybody has self-will. Everybody gets sick in self-will from time to time. Everybody overdoes in self-will from time to time. And everybody hurts other people in one way or another from time to time. Now, in this scheme of life, as I'm going through life, maybe somebody does something to me that hurts me. Something that threatens one of the basic instincts of life. Maybe they put me down in the eyes of other people and threaten my security, or my social instinct. Maybe they threaten my money. Maybe they steal from me. Maybe they rip me off and threaten my security. Or maybe they do something to threaten my sex life. And when they do that, that's not a resentment. That's a wrong on their part. They shouldn't do that. No human being should do something to hurt another human being. And when they do that, that's a wrong on their part. It's not a resentment. It isn't a resentment until I go across town and I sit down in my living room that evening and I replay that in my head. And as I replay that thing in my head, I feel the pain that came from it the first time. And I feel the suffering, and as I play it over and over and over in my head, I'm blaming it on them. But I'm doing it to myself. The first time they did it to me, the second time I do it to myself. And every time I replay that and re-feel that pain, then I am hurting myself the second, the third, the fourth, the fifth, the sixth time. And I'm not too awful honest either. I have a slight tendency that every time I replay that to change it just a little bit and make what they did a little bit worse and make the suffering and pain just a little bit deeper and make me just a little bit better. And as I replay that over and over and over and over in my head, I find it as I distort the picture until eventually it reaches the point where it's not even, doesn't even resemble the truth anymore. And I find, well, I'm able to say, well, I was just standing there doing nothing. And they came along and did it to me. Poor old me, they just did it on purpose. You know, a resentment is kind of like a football game. This is football season. I was watching one today. And you watch football on TV and you'll see a little back go out and to catch that ball. And he'll jump up in the air and he's about 3 foot off the ground. And one of those big bruisers that weighs about 250 will whack. They'll just knock the hell out of him. He's still up in the air. He's all stretched out. It turns him upside down. He falls on his head and it pretty well knocks him out. And you can see that it hurt him. And they'll stop the game, and they'll run out there, and they'll do one or two things with him. They'll either pump some more air in him and get him up and get him playing, or they'll drag him off to the side, and somebody will take his place, and they'll start, in either case, the game is going to go on. And the old announcer, though, he's got a resentment machine. He's not satisfied with that. He said, let's look at that again. And he turns on his replay machine. And when he turns on his replay machine, he shows us that whole picture over again, only this time it's in slow motion. And it's in living color. And my God, you can see the expression, the pain on that guy's face. You can see how far that arm really did bend back. You can see those legs split apart. And it looks twice as bad this time as it did the first time. And after a while he said, let's look at that again. Now the game's going on, and yet the announcer's still sitting over here bouncing this guy up and down off the ground. Now, we alcoholics are just like that. We are selfish and self-centered to the extreme. Now, we're not the only selfish, self-centered person in the world. Everybody is, but we are selfish and self-centered to the extreme. And we have up in our head a little resentment replay machine. And we get up in the morning and we tune it up in living color. And we leave the house and we shine it on the world all day long. And we record everything they do to us that's bad. We don't record anything that's good. We don't want none of that. We record everything they do to us that's bad, and we take it home at night and play it over and make ourselves sick and blame it on them. Some days they won't do anything to us. And that's a bad day for an alcoholic. When you got your machine tuned up and you shine it on the world and they won't do anything to you and you got nothing to record, that's a bad, bad day for an alcoholic, because we ain't going to have nothing to play when we get home that night. You know what we record then? By God, we record what they're thinking. That's what we do. And we'll replay what they're thinking, and that's just as bad, see? Is there any way that God can enter a mind that is filled with resentments? God gave us self-will. And according to the other big, big, big book, the story in there says that he said, I love you enough that I'll let you use it to destroy yourself if you want to. That I'll never take it back unless you freely give it back to me. And the only way we can freely give it back is to remove the things that block us off from doing that. And if your mind is filled with resentment, you can't give it to God, because God can't direct it, because whatever you resent is directing your mind. When your mind is concentrated on resentment for another person, place, or thing, then that thing is controlling your will, and you can't control it, and God can't control it. So the resentment's going to have to go if we want God to direct our thinking. Now, how are we going to get it to go? Very simple. We've got a little sheet of paper, and we're going to use a little form here, and I'm trying to hurry so we can get through as much of this as we can. I'm probably going to run until somebody tells me to quit, so when you all get tired, holler and we'll stop. On that sheet of paper, now this is nothing new. I want to tell you for sure that we're not trying to bring another inventory into AA. We've got enough of those already. I think one of our difficulties with step four has been the example on page 65 is already filled out. And we didn't understand the procedure bill used to fill it out. So what we're going to do is take that blank sheet and we're going to fill it out according to the instructions in the book. And if you'll notice, the first three columns on that sheet are exactly like page 65. You got the first column, I'm resentful at. The second column is the cause. The third column is affects my. Now the only thing we did any different, we took the third column, we subdivided it into the three basic instincts of life, and we used identically the same words that Bill uses in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. Under that third column, we put the social instinct, and under it, we put self-esteem, personal relationships. Under the security instinct, we put material and emotional. And under the sex instinct, we added two words. We put acceptable and hidden. Now, acceptable sex life is the life I would have in my home with my spouse. I look at it, and for as I can tell, it's okay. I'm sure that God's agreeable with that sex life, and probably society would be too if they saw it. And if you do anything to threaten it, you're going to make me madder in hell. But then some of us have another sex life too. Some of us tend to have a sex thing going on the side. We would rather keep it hidden and not let anybody know about it. You know, if we're a man, maybe we got a lady friend over there. Or if we're a lady, maybe we got a boyfriend over there. Or... hell, there might be anything over there. You know, a pet goat or a monkey or God only knows what. You do enough fifth steps, you'll cease to be amazed at what's over there. And I'll guarantee you, if you threaten my hidden sex life, you'll make me just as mad as you will if you threaten my acceptable sex life. In order for me to resent, to refeel that anger and that pain, there has to be a threat to one of the basic instincts of life. You threaten my social instinct, security instinct, sex instinct, or my ambitions, plans for the future, you're going to make me mad. Now let's see how we fill this out. Page 64, last paragraph. He said, in dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. He then said, we listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. Period. Stop right there. Now we're taught to read and write from left to right. But if we do that with a big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, in this inventory, we're going to have to put down a name, then the cause, then the part of self that was affected. We'll have to think about three different things. And then a second name, we'd have to think about three different things. And after you do that about four or five times, your mind just starts going in circles. So while we got one thing and one thing only on our mind, let's make a list of people, institutions, and principles to whom we're angry. Let's go from top to bottom. Let's start with the people. That's self-explanatory. The institutions are such things as the police department, the federal government, the Internal Revenue Service, the church, all the institutions we get upset with. Principles are those old, old guiding spiritual principles we've heard all of our lives that irritated the hell out of us as alcoholics because it interferes with our style of living. The Ten Commandments, they're a set of spiritual principles. God, I hated to hear them. Didn't want to hear them at all because I had already broken damn near every one of them. Another old principle I never did like said, what goes up must come down. Another one said, what you get out is what you get back. Another one said, there are no free rides. You'll pay for everything you get. And one my daddy uses, I've always hated. He said, you lay down with the dogs, you'll get fleas on you every time. Those things irritated the hell out of me when I was drinking. So all I'm going to do for the first instruction is take them out of my head, put them on a piece of paper. Now, you don't have to be sober a long time to do this. And you don't have to be highly educated to do this. And if you can't write, you feed the names to somebody else and have them write them down. I have never seen an alcoholic yet that does not know just exactly who and what by God they're mad at. Hell, we spend hours and hours and hours sitting around in bars and places talking about it. All we got to do is take it out of our head, put it on a piece of paper, and we've done the first instruction. Now, if you're anything like me, I think you're going to be absolutely amazed when you do this. Bill, you notice, had four. He said, Mr. Brown, Miss Jones, my employer, and my wife.